Okay, great. Hi, everybody. Thanks for letting me come in. I'm glad you're all here and made it through the potential storm that we almost had and one that we will probably have this weekend. So here's what my plan is today. Marianne asked me to come in and talk a little bit about the Reformation. So I'm going to talk, I'll talk a little bit about that. There's kind of two approaches that I could have taken. Maybe there's probably 200 approaches I could have taken. The two I considered was to get really specific and do a handout and all that kind of stuff. And then I just thought, my guess is for most of you, and not just because it's you, but for most people, the basics is what you're looking for. Why did the Reformation happen? Who are some of the main movers and shakers? What are some of the results of the Reformation that reach even into today? And so I want to do that for probably a half an hour or so, and then I'm just going to open it up for questions, and you can ask whatever questions you'd like to ask, okay? And if you don't have many questions, then I'll just turn it right back over to Marianne, and you all can do whatever you're going to do. And if you have a lot of questions, then I'll answer questions until you're done, I guess, right?
Okay, well, we're done at 11.
We're done at 11. Okay, so there you go. So I'm willing to stay until 11, if that's what you would like. And but if you're done with questions and things like that, then I'll be done as well. So I am being recorded. So if you have questions, remind me to repeat your questions so that they will go into the recording. Okay, because I will surely forget. Let me pray, and then we'll begin this morning. So, Lord, as we talk about this really critical period of time, at least for the Western world, I pray that you would give me insight and an ability to communicate clearly, and Lord God, that you would be with each one of these folks that are here this morning as well, as questions arise in their minds, as we try to formulate proper responses, and as we try to learn and to increase our knowledge on some of these important matters, historical and theological and biblical. And so help us to do those things, I pray in the name of Jesus. Amen. Okay, so if we're going to talk about the Reformation, the first thing we need to talk about, at least real briefly, is just an overview of Roman Catholicism. Now, that sounds like you can't do that briefly, and really, you can't, other than to say, I will talk briefly just about what were some of the things taking place in the Roman Catholic Church that led to the Reformation. So just so that you're aware of it, I was raised Roman Catholic, first 18 years of my life. I was Roman Catholic, altar boy, the whole nine yards, youngest of 14 kids, quintessential Roman Catholic family. Some of my family are still Roman Catholic. My parents both passed away Roman Catholic. So I am not anti-Roman Catholic, okay? I am, however, a Protestant. I've been Protestant longer than I was Roman Catholic, and I have serious theological issues with some parts of Roman Catholicism that relate right back to the Reformation. The reasons why I'm now Protestant and not Roman Catholic. So if you're here today and you have either roots in Roman Catholicism or you're still practicing Roman Catholicism, please do not sense, I hope, that this is me saying the big bad Roman Catholic Church, in came Martin Luther, the great hero of the world, who was a saint and fixed everything, and, you know, down with the Roman Catholics and up with the Protestants. That's not my point at all, okay? So we need to understand some basic concepts of Roman Catholic teaching in order to understand why the Reformation took place at all. The Roman Catholic Church is very, very old. The Roman Catholic dogma or the teaching of the church is that the Roman Catholic Church is the one true church. They would say that because their teaching is that Matthew chapter 16, where Peter made this great proclamation of faith, where Jesus says, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter said, "You are the Christ, you are the Son of the living God." Jesus turned to him and said, "You are Peter. And upon this rock," Peter means in Greek, rock or stone, actually means more like a pebble, but upon this stone, upon this rock, I'm going to build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. The Roman Catholic Church teaches that was Jesus conferring upon Peter the keys of the church and saying, "You're the one that I will build this church on. And from now on, the whole succession of leaders of the church will come through you. And so the Catholic Church teaches that Peter, when he died, passed on his leadership to a gentleman by the name of Linus, who became really the first pope. And then there is a direct succession of popes all the way back to Peter. So the pope that we have today, we can follow a direct line all the way back to Peter, which makes the pope what they call the vicar of Christ. He is Christ's representative on earth. The Roman Empire was built under the understanding that the city of Rome was the mother of the Roman Empire, and Caesar was the father of the Roman Empire. The Roman Catholic Church took that same kind of concept and said, Rome is the mother of the church, and the Pope is the father of the church. And therefore, Roman Catholic dogma, even to this day, is that there is one true church, and that is the Church of Rome. And the Church of Rome has what they call the Curia, which is the teaching office or the magisterium. You don't need to remember all these words, but these are the teaching office of the church. So the church is headed by the pope, the word pope comes from the word papa, which simply means father. And the pope is the main representative of Christ to this world through the Church of Rome. But around him is gathered the curia, or the magisterium, the teaching office of the church. That is the cardinals and the bishops of the church. And this teaching curia, or this magisterium, they teach with the authority of Christ, the pope being the one who kind of designates whether or not this is true teaching or not. And so the church would simply teach that the truth stands on two main pillars: the Bible, which most of us would all agree with, but also the church. You cannot understand the Bible without the church helping you to understand the Bible. Therefore, church tradition holds equal authority to the Bible, okay? So today when you have people, Protestants, who say, you Catholics, you teach about purgatory, and I don't find purgatory in the Bible, any good Catholic worth their salt would say, it doesn't have to say it in the Bible, the church teaches it. Therefore, it has equal authority. It's as if the Bible says it. Okay. Now, they would also point to a few passages in the New Testament that they would say lean towards the concept of purgatory. Okay, so that's kind of a foundational thought you have to know that's going on in the Roman Catholic Church all the way through the ages. Now, again, Catholics would teach that the church has basically existed since the time of Christ. Christ established the church through Peter. Peter went off to, eventually was martyred in Rome. Good church history tells us that. Peter died and was buried. They built St. Peter's Basilica on top of his tomb, and literally the church is built on Peter. St. Peter's being the main edifice of the Roman Catholic Church there in Vatican City on top of the tomb of Peter. Incidentally, who else are we almost sure historically was martyred in Rome? Paul, right. So the Catholic Church would say it's built on the two pillars of Peter and Paul. Both having come to Rome, both being martyred in Rome, giving, again, great prestige to the church there. So, hence today you have Vatican City, the smallest nation in the world. It's an independent nation, only a few square miles in size, but it's its own nation state, as it was in the time of the Reformation, which was the early to the middle part of the 16th century that went really basically through the 16th century. And remember, when we say 16th century, we mean the 1500s. That's kind of the time of the Reformation. And at that time, not only was Rome and the Vatican City its own nation state, but the nation, as it were, of Rome was massive. It included most of Europe, what they called the Holy Roman Empire. Huge history that goes behind all that. Remember, Rome fell in about the 5th century, essentially, A.D. But by the Middle Ages, they had kind of reestablished, hoping to reestablish the Roman Empire. And this time they called it the Holy Roman Empire because now it was based on Christianity, not on paganism. And the Pope during the time of Martin Luther, presided over a massive part of Western Europe, what they called the Holy Roman Empire. The church had become a political entity, very, very strong, powerful political entity, and the Pope wielded that power by saying, because the keys were given to Peter, and because of what they call the donation, we don't have any markers, do we? Oh, okay. A very major issue during that time, and still to this day, it's called the donation of Constantine. Anybody ever heard of that? The donation of Constantine. The story is that the Roman Catholic Church still holds in its vaults in Vatican City a letter written by Constantine, the great emperor who converted to Christianity, so-called, and announced the Edict of Milan, which said the Roman Empire is no longer pagan, it is now Christian in the early fourth century. And he moved his capital of the Roman Empire from Rome up to the city of Constantinople. Constantine is now Istanbul. It's ruled by a Muslim nation now. But he moved, I'm doing that because Italy is like this and Rome is here and Istanbul is way up here on the Black Sea. Constantinople, he moved his capital up to Constantinople and wrote a letter to the Pope saying, as I move the Roman Empire, its capital to Constantine, I give to you, the Pope, all the Western Hemisphere. You will rule over the Western Hemisphere. Nobody, as far as we know, has ever seen this letter, but apparently this letter, according to the Roman Church, exists in the vaults of Rome. It's called the Donation of Constantine, which said, the Pope now rules over the western half of the Roman Empire. This is what the popes then said, hey, now we have political authority. We will appoint emperors and kings and all these kind of things. So all that has now taken place and is in place. The Roman Church would say, we've been around since the beginning and since the time of Christ. Protestants would say, well, actually history would say it's more like the Roman Catholic Church as we know it today has been around since probably Pope Gregory the Great, who incidentally, that's where I got my last name. My father was an immigrant, and his last name was Gergerich, and the Catholic priest said, it's not good to have an immigrant's name in America at this time, so change it. Actually, it was my grandfather, and my grandfather said, what'd I change it to? And he said, Pope Gregory. Gregory would be a great last name, so that's my last name now, Gregory. Pope Gregory the Great, which in the early part of the 6th century, actually a very, very, if you read about Pope Gregory, a very, very solid, godly Christian man. But most would trace it back to Boniface, Pope Boniface, who came right after Pope Gregory at the beginning part of the 6th century, who began to exert more of a control over the world and over Christianity, and began to exert the influence of saying, I'm the Pope, and when I speak for Christ, and therefore when I say it, it's true. It is without error. It is without fault. To this day, the Roman Catholic Church would teach that when the Pope sits on the throne of Peter, it's called ex cathedra, from the seat, from the chair, when the Pope speaks from the chair, it is infallible. It cannot be wrong. Not everything the Pope says is infallible, but when the Pope has thought through it, gotten counsel from the magisterium, and then sits on the throne of Peter and writes a papal bull and a statement, it is without error. It's as if Paul or James or anybody else was writing from the Bible. It is without error. What he says cannot be contradicted or contracted. Okay? Hasn't done that for a very long time. Last time a pope did that was in the middle part of the 1800s when the Pope spoke ex cathedra and said that the body of Mary, the mother of Jesus, did not suffer any defilement or decaying, but was assumed bodily into heaven. And now Mary is what they call the Queen of Heaven. So it's nowhere in the Bible, but the Pope did speak that ex cathedra, which now becomes Catholic dogma. It is now truth without any mixture of error. Okay? So this is the foundation of what Luther was addressing in the 14th century. This had now grown over 1,000 years. The Papal States had grown in power politically and theologically. And there was a lot of corruption. And any good Catholic today, and any good Catholic theologian today would say, absolutely. Many good Catholics of that time knew that there was great corruption in the Catholic Church. So all the way back into like the 13th century, you have a guy named Robert Grotesete, I think is how he pronounced his last name, who was a bishop of Rome, who wrote against the Roman Empire and against the Pope and said, this is just wrong. Some of these things are absolutely wrong. The teaching is wrong. We should be preaching the Bible, not only doing the Mass. So many things we're doing wrong. He preached in English in Great Britain. He was the Bishop of Lincoln. He preached in English, which was absolutely forbidden by the Roman Catholic Church. Everything had to be done in Latin. The reason why it needed to be done in Latin is because you can't just have your peasants and people hearing the Bible in their own language, because if they do, they're just going to mess it up. The Bible is too holy and too in-depth for normal human beings like us to understand. You need to be a priest or a bishop or a cardinal to understand this. So what the church was doing was protecting people by doing the Mass in Latin so they couldn't understand it. And therefore, when they had questions, they would go to the priest, and the priest could then give them a proper interpretation or understanding of the Bible. So people think that it's just because the church wanted to protect itself. There might be some of that, but most of it was they were trying to protect people from knowing the Bible and then really messing up the Bible. Hence, when the Reformation came around and Martin Luther said, let people read the scriptures, the Catholic Church says you're going to have a huge mess on your hands if people actually read the scriptures. And so you have the Mass being said only in Latin. The phrase hocus pocus, you've heard of that, right? The magic term. It comes from the Latin Mass. Hoc est corpus meum. This is my body. The priest every time, even to this day, holds up in the Latin Mass. They don't do that very often anymore, but holds up the host, says hoc est corpus meum. This is my body. But most priests, they did not want to take the time to learn Latin. They just memorized the Latin Mass. They didn't understand Latin. They just memorized the Mass. And they conflated a lot of terms. And hoc est corpus meum became hocus pocus. And for a lot of people, it just became the concept of magic. This host is going to turn into literally the body of Jesus. Something magic is happening here. Hocus pocus is happening here. This is becoming literally the body of Jesus when we look at it and we say, this is bread and we're about to consume it. So the church was trying to protect people from the Bible and from misunderstanding the Bible. But you've got a guy way back in the 13th century, this British bishop who's saying, no, this is wrong. And he's preaching in English. But he was so popular and he was such a well-known scholar, an Oxford scholar, that even the Pope could not settle that issue all the way up there in Great Britain. And so he was able to die in peace. But early on, you see people coming along. And so you've got people like that most people don't know. Others, John Wycliffe. Some of you will know the name of John Wycliffe, again, a British man who began to preach in English as well and began to denounce the Pope and the excesses of Roman Catholicism, of the Catholic Church. Wycliffe was eventually strangled and then burned at the stake. No, I take that back. That was Huss. Wycliffe died in peace, but his bones were exhumed about 40 years later, and then they were burned and they were thrown into the River Swift to teach him a lesson for his heresies. After Wycliffe came Jan Hus, and Jan Hus, long story there, but Hus was also one who attacked the extravagances of the Pope. The Pope lived in great wealth while so many were suffering, so many peasants were suffering, and he felt that was wrong and wrote against some of those kind of things and was eventually given what they call safe passage to come and debate this with some Catholic cardinals. And at the end of the debate, they disagreed with him, and then they decided, well, you don't really have to honor your word to a heretic. So his safe passage was revoked. He was in prison for about 6 months, and then he was burned at the stake. So these kind of things were happening in the 13th, 14th, and early part of the 15th century. So by the time Martin Luther is born in 1483, the Catholic Church is entrenched, it is strong, and yet there are many who are saying there's some problems with the Catholic Church. Most notably, one of the wisest and probably the most intellectual men of that age, a man by the name of Erasmus. Have you heard the term, the name Erasmus before? Desiderius Erasmus. He devoted his life to the study of the Greek New Testament in order that he could translate that Greek New Testament into the Latin in a purer form. But he also, Erasmus, was a reformer, and he wanted to reform the church from the inside. He was from Rotterdam in the Netherlands. But he was more of a, he was a kind of a gentle kind of a guy and said, hey, let's just kind of find a middle ground. You've got these people who say, no, the Bible seems to teach that we're saved by faith. And the Catholic Church says we're saved by faith and our good works. And only through the Catholic Church. If you're not Catholic, you're going to hell, straight to hell. And Erasmus said, there's probably some middle ground there. And he tried to find this middle ground. And he wrote this treatise called The Freedom of the Will, saying human beings, God gave us freedom to think for ourselves and to respond in faith to God. And the Freedom of the Will was very well received by people. Erasmus was a scholar. He had translated from the original Greek text into the Latin, and people highly, highly respected him. But along comes this guy in 1483, Martin Luther, born in 1483 to Catholic parents, born right there in the middle of Germany. Part of the Holy Roman Empire, and Luther was raised by his parents to be a good Catholic. The patron saint of the family was Saint Anne, who, according to church tradition, was the mother of Mary. Mary's mother's name was Anne, and so Saint Anne was their patron saint of the family. And Luther was raised to be a lawyer. His father was a miner in silver, and had some financial means. And his goal was that his son was not going to work with his hands. His son was going to be a scholar. So he wanted him to be a lawyer. And so he sent his son off in about 14. Back then, by the time you were 12 or 13 years old, if you showed any promise, you were shipped off somewhere to go to school. And so that's what Luther did. Went off to be a lawyer. And many of you have probably heard this story. One day he's coming back. There's a great storm. Lightning strikes near him. He is very superstitious. He is fearful that God is angry with him and is going to kill him with lightning. And so he cries out, Saint Anne, save me. If you will save me, I will become a monk. And he makes it home safely. And Luther tells his father and mother, I'm going to be a monk. And his father was furious with this. But Luther had made a pledge to St. Anne, and so he left his studies to be a lawyer and joined Augustinian monastery and became a monk, became a priest. So Luther, for the first 10, 15 years of his ministry, was actually a practicing Augustinian monk, Catholic priest. But he was a scholar. He was beset with all kinds of thoughts of how wicked he was and how sinful he was and how angry God was at his sin. And so he went to his confessor. Any good Catholic would go to somebody, usually a priest, to confess their sin. And his confessor was another monk who was older than him. And he would confess his sins. And then about 3 hours later, he would come back to confess again. And his confessor finally said, Martin, you're driving yourself insane, you know. But Luther could not get over the fact that he was a rotten sinner and that God was going to punish him for his sin, even though he was a very, very fine monk. So his confessor said, I'm going to send you off to university. You need to go get a doctorate degree. You got to have something to think about other than your own sin. So he sent him off to get his doctorate degree. Luther did that. And then in 1510, Luther got the opportunity of a lifetime for an Augustinian monk. He was sent on monastery business to the city of Rome. And he journeyed to Rome. And he says that when he first saw the city from the distance, he fell on his face and thanked God and Saint Anne for giving him the opportunity to see the holy city. And he went, and the holy city of Rome was filled with relics. Relics are religious items that bear religious significance and, according to the Catholic Church, can bestow grace upon a person if they can touch them or if they can pray before them. And so Rome was full of relics, right? And he couldn't wait to get there and to go see all the relics. And he did. He went from one place to another. Eventually, he did what any good Catholic would want to do if they got to Rome, and that was to scale what they called the Scala Sancta, the holy stairs. According to tradition, when the Roman Empire took over Jerusalem and burned the temple and everything else, some were able to take the stairs that led up to the place where Pilate judged Jesus, those stone stairs. They were able to take them and abscond with them to Rome. And those stairs are still there in Rome today, they say. They were the stairs that Jesus himself walked up to be punished or to be condemned by Pilate. The tradition was that if you would scale those stairs on your knees, kissing each step and reciting the Lord's Prayer on every step, by the time you got to the top, you would have won salvation for any one person that you would choose other than yourself. You would win salvation for somebody else. And his goal was to win salvation for his mother, even though his mother was a very good Catholic. Again, Luther just believed we're all sinners and we're probably all going to hell. So he scaled the stairs, and when he got to the top, he had this revelation of, what if I bloodied my knees and my elbows and all this for nothing? Who says this is true? And Luther began to very much question in his mind the reality of all of this stuff. So he went back to Germany, and again, other things happened. So let me pick up the pace here. Here's the main things then that eventually led to Luther posting what they call the 95 Theses there in 1517 on the Wittenberg door in Germany. The issue of papal extravagances. The Pope was living in grand splendor when so many were living in poverty in his empire. One other thing is this concept of indulgences. Have you heard of indulgences? The Catholic Church still teaches that indulgences are valid. An indulgence is a good work that you might do, a merit that you might do for the Church, that the Church, the Pope, who is the vicar of Christ and holds the keys of hell and death, the Pope has what they call this treasury of merits. Jesus had so many merits that they're inexhaustible. But their saints also, these great saints who have lived, they also have attributed a lot of merit. Good deeds is what merits are. So everybody who dies, you're likely to spend a huge amount of time, maybe literally thousands of years in purgatory. Because even though Christ died for our sins, we're not actually cleared of these things yet until we do penance. And we're not able to do most of that in life. We just commit too many sins. So we need a time before we can actually stand before Holy God. We need to have that purged from us in purgatory. So almost everybody's going to go to purgatory for a really long time. But the Pope, because he's the vicar of Christ and holds the keys of hell and death, he can offer what's called an indulgence, which an indulgence may take off a year out of purgatory, or 10 years. The Pope decides. You get 100 years off of purgatory, or 1,000 years off of purgatory. If you do a good deed, indulgences arose, we think, primarily out of the First Crusade, when they needed men from the West to go all the way to Jerusalem, to reconquer Jerusalem from the Muslims. And the Pope said, you know what? If you will go on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem and retake the city, you will all receive what's called a plenary indulgence. Anybody who serves will get a plenary indulgence, which means you don't even have to go to purgatory. You die, you go straight to heaven. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people in Europe joined the ranks to march on Jerusalem. And they took Jerusalem with the promise that if I die in battle, I go straight to heaven. No purgatory there. It's a cheap thing that the Pope can do, right? Costs the Pope nothing, but it can raise massive armies. And the Church also found out it can raise a massive amount of money, too. So we can also give indulgences if you'll give money. This was anathema to Luther. As a monk, he saw peasants trying to come up with just any amount of money they could to buy a few years of indulgence for maybe a deceased mother or father, or more likely for a child who had died. And they could not conceive of their child being in purgatory, so they would pay large sums of money so that they could get an indulgence, so their child could get out of the torments of purgatory and get into the bliss of heaven. So this was a massive deal in the late 15th century, early 16th century. And Luther and others, Wycliffe and others, had attacked these as well. This was one of the main issues for Luther. They were trying to rebuild St. Peter's Basilica, and the Pope needed funding. And so he sent out a guy by the name of John Tetzel out into Europe to raise money. And he was raising millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars by going out and selling indulgences to peasants. And he had this statement: as soon as the coin in the coffer rings, the soul from purgatory springs. You drop the coin in the coffer, you get your signed indulgence, and off goes another soul has just made it into heaven. Now, this is going to sound really graphic, and it was graphic then too. Tetzel believed so much in these indulgences that he, one of the things that he would put on papers when he was coming into a city, they would send other monks before them and say, Tetzel's coming into the city, indulgences will be sold on this day, and they would hang banners all over. And one of them, forgive me for sounding graphic, but this is what they said, that if a person purchased an indulgence, even if they had raped the mother of God, God would forgive that sin and send them into heaven. So you can see the grossness of this practice. Luther despised it as a monk and as a priest. And he was beginning to read the scriptures. He was now teaching through the book of Romans in the Wittenberg church. And he was studying. Not only was he coming over under personal conviction, but under a corporate conviction over the state of the Roman Catholic Church at that time. So that was Luther's primary concern. So on October the 31st, 1517, the next day, All Saints Day, they were going to be in Wittenberg selling indulgences. And so on October 31st, he went to the door of the Wittenberg church and he posted what is known as the 95 Theses. Most people say this starts the Protestant theses. I should know how to spell that. Yes, right? Theses. So Luther posted the 95 Theses. Now, here's what is the misunderstanding of the 95 Theses. Number one, why post them on the Wittenberg door, on the door of the church? Well, because the door of the church, which is still there today, although covered now in bronze, was a big, massive wooden structure, and it was the billboard for the city. When you had an announcement to make, you posted it on the door of the church. Then everybody would see it because everybody was going to Mass every day. So it was a big billboard is what it was. Luther posted it there because everybody would see it the next morning before the guy came in to sell the indulgences. Other people think that the 95 Theses were these 95 grand statements about salvation by faith through grace, by grace through faith alone, and all these grand concepts of the Protestant Reformation. It was not that at all. It was basically 95 statements saying this is why indulgences are wrong. And it was written in Latin, not in German. And that was because Luther was not trying to create a great storm. He was inviting other Catholic scholars to debate with him, and it was only the scholars who could read Latin. So the common people would not even understood what the 95 Theses were about. Only the scholars, the Catholic teachers would see that and would be able to respond to this. It was an invitation to a discussion on the sale of indulgences. So not quite as grand as everybody thinks. Luther himself would say it was 2 or 3 years after he posted the 95 Theses before his concepts of salvation by grace through faith, had kind of solidified and what stirred him up to begin what was known as the Protestant Reformation. Keep this in mind because this is important. Erasmus, he wanted he saw great extravagances in the Catholic Church and great corruption, and he wanted to address it. He wanted to do it kind of in a very simple manner. Luther, by the time his theology has developed, he also wants to cleanse the church. But he's far more dogmatic, whereas Erasmus was more of what we call a humanist, more of a humans have great potential and we are wonderful things. And really, Erasmus would say, when we sin, God kind of smiles at it because we're doing our best. And Luther would say, God doesn't smile at sin. God sends sinners to hell. This is what the scriptures teach, and it has to be addressed theologically. We have to address the church theologically, where Erasmus said, let's just address the church kind of in a humanitarian way. This doesn't seem right. Let's discuss this. Both wanted to reform the church from the inside. Luther had no intentions in 1517 when he posted the 95 Theses of starting a new church. That was never his intention at that time. He was a monk. He was Augustinian. He was a Catholic priest. He said the Mass every single day. He was not about to start a new church. That would only come later. He began to write tracts and treaties. One of the things that advanced the Protestant Reformation probably more than anything else was what? Can anybody think of what it might have been? What was invented in the middle part? The printing press. All of a sudden now when you write a tract, it doesn't have to be handwritten. You could print them by the hundreds, the thousands, and send them out. And Luther took great, great advantage of the printing press, the new printing press. And so he wrote a lot of tracts and treaties and books that were reprinted and sent out. And so Luther, most of the Protestant Reformation took place in writing. It wasn't like Luther was a great traveler and traveled all over the empire to speak and to preach. He just wrote tracts and they got distributed all over the place. And so Luther was a great writer. In response to Erasmus's The Freedom of the Will, Luther wrote was probably this his most important work, and that was called The Bondage of the Will. And he addressed Erasmus. And quite frankly, even Erasmus did not really want to take on the task of writing the book, The Freedom of the Will. And so in his own writings, he said, I really didn't put a lot of effort into it. And boy, did Luther tear him apart in the Bondage of the Will. He took Erasmus's argument and just shredded it biblically and said, that argument, here's a biblical argument. And that concept spread like wildfire. And now all of a sudden, Reformation was beginning. But it wasn't a reformation from within anymore. Now people were saying, we have to, the Roman Church has to go. It's been around too long. It is too corrupt. The Pope is too corrupt. People can't even understand the scriptures in their own language anymore. And so that was kind of the start of the Protestant Reformation, was Luther beginning to write. And his writings made it all the way to Rome. And the Pope, Pope Leo X, read them. And Pope Leo X wrote what was called a papal bull. And in that papal bull, the bull in English is translated, Rise up, O Lord. And he said, there's this great rotten boar in Germany. He called Luther the great German boar, B-O-A-R, pig, who was taking on the Roman Catholic Church, and how dare he. And he excommunicated Luther and said, Luther's writings are to be burned and Luther is to be excommunicated from the church. Remember, there is no salvation outside of the Roman Catholic Church. So he's saying Luther's going to hell, and so is anybody else who agrees with Luther. The bull, a copy of it, came to Wittenberg. It was shown to Luther. Luther went to the town square, held it up, read it to the people that Luther was now a heretic and was excommunicated from the Catholic Church, and all of his writings were to be burned, and Luther burned the papal bull in public. That's probably where we begin the Protestant Reformation. Now Luther has broken from the church, and now he is writing very, very strong tracts against the Pope and against the Roman Catholic Church, calling the Pope the Antichrist. He says that the Pope calls himself the Vicar of Christ, and yet he does not represent Christ. The only term that can be equated to him must be Antichrist. You can imagine what that would do in the 16th century in Europe to be calling the Pope the Antichrist. So that's the beginning of the Protestant Reformation. Much, much, much more could be said. Luther was under constant attack for the next 30 years of his life. He died in his mid-60s. He didn't live to be very old. Let me say this, a few things about Luther. Luther was an incredible scholar. Luther was an incredibly godly man. Luther was about as crass as they come. He was, he loved drinking Wittenberg beer. He loved bodily noises and things of that nature. He talked about them. He wrote a lot about his bowels. He said some things that were just crass, quite frankly. An incredibly godly man, but was also just kind of your stereotypical German guy, you know, at the same time. So he had feet of clay, no question about it. But there is no question that Luther was a scholar extraordinaire. He knew Latin, German, French. He was a scholar. Let me read to you what Luther himself said some years after the Reformation began. And he's writing a preface to all of his Latin works. And so in his own words, let him describe himself. Though I lived as a monk without reproach, I felt that I was a sinner before God with an extremely disturbed conscience. I could not believe that he was placated by my satisfaction. I did not love, yes, I hated the righteous God who punishes sinners, and secretly, if not blasphemously, certainly murmured greatly. I was angry with God and said, as if indeed it is not enough that miserable sinners eternally lost their original sin are crushed by every kind of calamity by the law of the Decalogue, that's the Ten Commandments, without having God add pain to pain by the gospel and also by the gospel threatening us with his righteousness and wrath, thus I raged with a fierce and troubled conscience. Nevertheless, I beat importunately upon Paul at that place. He's talking about Romans 1:17, where Paul tells us that the righteous will live by faith. He's quoting from Habakkuk in the Old Testament. When Luther read that, he said, who is righteous? How can we live by faith? God is basically just saying, here's an unattainable standard. Now reach the standard which nobody can reach. And Luther thought, that's horrible that God would do that. I beat importunately upon Paul at that place. He studied Romans over and over and over again. What could Paul possibly be saying here about this? Most ardently desiring to know what St. Paul wanted. At last, by the mercy of God, meditating day and night, I gave heed to the context of the words. Namely, in it the righteousness of God is revealed, as it is written, he who through faith is righteous shall live. So what does Luther do? He says, I went to it, and now instead of just taking it what we call eisegetically, one passage, pulling it out and saying, this is what I'm going to study, he takes it and he does it exegetically, which means it's in context. Let the context tell you what this sentence means, which is any good practice of how we read the Bible, in context, right? Anybody can pull one text out of anywhere, right? What's the one that everybody loves so much from Matthew 17? Judge not, lest ye be judged. So you can't say anything about anything I do because judge not, lest ye be judged. Pulled completely out of context, one verse, and it says everything you want it to say. The problem is that's not what Jesus, I mean, he certainly meant we shouldn't be those who are judgmental, but it doesn't mean you can never say something is wrong. So, at last, by the mercy of God, meditating day and night, I gave heed to the context of the words, namely, in it the righteousness of God is revealed, as it is written, he who through faith is righteous shall live. There I began to understand that the righteousness of God is that by which the righteous live by a gift of God, namely by faith. And this is the meaning. The righteousness of God is revealed by the gospel, namely the passive righteousness with which the merciful God justifies us by faith. Passive righteousness simply means we don't earn our salvation. It is passive. It's passive because it's given to us by Jesus, by faith. We receive righteousness as a gift from God by placing our faith in Jesus Christ. We're passive. God is active in that, Luther says, and I believe Paul says as well. He who through faith is righteous shall live. Here I felt that I was altogether born again and had entered paradise itself through open gates. So it was there in Romans 1:17 that Paul, or that Luther eventually felt like he had kind of reached the point where he now understood how we are to stand before a holy God one day. That God is a righteous God, yes, and he will judge sinners. But by his grace, those who have received his son through faith, God gives righteousness to them passively. We don't earn it. Now again, Luther was not saying good works are not important. Luther was, all you got to do is read Luther's works and know he believed that we should do good works and that we should live righteous lives. But he just did not believe, and again, as Protestants would teach, we are saved by grace through faith. It's not a work of our own, okay? So, one more thing that happens that's kind of a big turn for the Reformation, and then I'll see if you have any questions. 1521, Luther is now called to the city of Worms, which is kind of right in the heart of Germany. It's spelled W-O-R-M-S, Worms, but it's pronounced Worms. And he's called to Worms under safe passage to come to Worms and to answer to the Roman Catholic Church, to a not the Pope, to a representative from the Roman Catholic Church, with Prince Charles V, who was now only 21 years old, but now elected Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, which means he rules Europe, and he's going to be there. Charles V, he wants to squash this Reformation, because what he needs is he needs to build a united Christian army to fight against the Muslims who are now in Vienna and are going to take Vienna, and he has this great battle plan, and he needs Christians united to form one massive army to take on the Muslims. So he wants to squash this. So he calls Luther to Worms. Luther goes to Worms. People telling Luther, do not go under safe passage. You know what safe passage is like. We know that from some others. Safe passage is not safe passage. But Luther says, though there be as many devils as there are tiles on the roofs in Worms, I will go to Worms. And so he went to Worms. And when he arrived there, he went into a room with the Holy Roman Emperor there. And John Eck, who was a great Catholic scholar and a Catholic cardinal there to defend the Catholic cause, along with many others that were there. And when he walked into a room, I guess similar to this, on the table were all his writings, copies of his writings. In fact, when the Holy Roman Emperor, 21 years old, walked in and saw them before Luther got there, he said, it's impossible that any one man could write all this. This can't all be Luther's work. Nobody could write this much stuff. But it was all Luther's. And they had Luther stand before them. They said, we're going to make this quick and simple. Here's your books. Do you recant? Do you say these are wrong? Or do you stand behind them? That's the only question we have for you. Luther thought about it, and he said, well, here's the problem. There's kind of three different things I wrote about. Number one, some of these books are just about good Christian living. Nobody would argue with that, not even anybody here. Not even the emperor or Johann Eck would argue with that. Another one is some concepts about the Catholic Church that we all acknowledge are excesses. We all acknowledge that. So I can't recant for that. Some others are some writings that are pretty polemic, or in other words, they're kind of harsh. He said, I need to think about those and pray about them. Would you give me one day? And so they gave him, the emperor said, by my great, you know, indulgence, I will give you one day to think and pray about this. Luther went back, prayed about it, came back the next day and said, here's the deal. Here's these three types of writings. The first two I can't recant. The third type, the polemical writings, I will say this. I wrote some hard things in there. If you will open the scriptures and show me where I said, what I said was wrong, I will recant of every one of them and I'll be the first to throw them into the fire. All you have to do is open the scriptures and show me where I'm wrong. And Eck said, you're kind of beating around the bush here. We asked you a direct question. Do you recant or do you not recant? That's the only question. We don't want any other explanations, just yes or no. And Luther said, well, if you're going to put it that way, I'm not quoting directly, but he said, I cannot recant. I will not recant because we have known that the Pope and some of his councils have erred. We know that to be true. Therefore, they cannot be inerrant. And it is neither safe nor is it godly to go against one's Christian conscience. Therefore, unless I can be shown by Scripture that I am wrong, I will not recant. Here I stand. God help me. And that was the end. He left. His safe passage was granted to some extent, but he needed to get out of town in a hurry. So he got out of town. As he left, he was kidnapped by some people who were on his side. They took him to the castle of Wartburg, and there he hid for over a year from the authorities in the castle of Wartburg. And while he was there, he translated the entire Bible from Latin into and from some of the original Greek manuscripts, too, that he could have access to. Not the original as in the autographs, but some of the oldest of the Greek manuscripts into the German Vulgate, or the natural language of German, so that Germans could read the Bible. To this day, that is the translation of the Bible in German. So Luther was an incredible scholar. And as people, multiple scholars now gather together to go through his translation, although they find some errors, they find it to be incredibly, incredibly accurate. It's still the German translation to this day. So By the time he left the castle of Wartburg, the Reformation had taken hold. He was protected by a prince in Germany who protected him from the Pope and from others. Emperor Charles was busy trying to fight the Muslims and kind of lost interest in Luther. And Luther was able to die by natural causes at 63 years of age. But he had stirred, you know, the Reformation. Not Luther alone. No time to talk about multiple others who were involved in some of that as well. So, okay? So that's the basis of the Protestant Reformation. Most people would say it started on October 31st of 1517. Luther would say it probably started more like about 1521. Nevertheless, it started there in Germany. It grew out from there into places like Great Britain, where you had people like John Knox, and others, William Tyndale, who were now getting the spirit of the Reformation and translating the Bible into English for English speakers, and all this kind of stuff happened in Great Britain and across the European continent. And hence we have the Protestant Church, which is also now broken up into multiple different denominations, right? Lutheranism and Methodism and out of Great Britain, and Presbyterianism out of Scotland, and all the way down to places like Life Point Church, where we say we're non-denominational. We're not planting our flag on any one of those denominations. So, okay? All right. Questions? Comments? Yes?
Where are his papers today?
Luther's papers? Most of them are in museums. A lot of the originals are there. What a lot of people don't remember is that Luther was also, again, this man was just incredibly well educated and just had an incredible intellect. He was also a musician, and he wrote many hymns, the most famous being what? A Mighty Fortress Is Our God. Yeah.
But they're not in one location, they're spread out.
Yes. Yeah.
Where is he buried?
He is buried underneath the pulpit of the Wittenberg Church in Germany, where he preached from. Yeah. He stopped doing the Mass and started preaching the gospel from that pulpit and from others as well. And so now he is his grave is underneath the pulpit at the Wittenberg Church there in Germany.
Were there elements of liturgy in his preaching?
Yes. Yeah, the interesting thing is that Luther was far more Catholic in terms of how the main thing for Luther was there's not seven sacraments, as the church would teach. There's two. Jesus, you know, told us that we were to practice what two? Communion and the Lord's Supper, right? Luther said there might be a third, and that might be confession. Confession may still need be one of the things that Christ ordained for us to do as what we would call a sacrament or an ordinance. But Luther, if you know, even to this day, if you go to a Lutheran church, you're going to find it's liturgical. It's not free. And by free, I don't mean free as in better. I just mean not tied to the church calendar and are tied to a liturgical type of readings and things like that, like you would have here at Life Point. So Luther really, as some other Protestants kind of broke away as well, like Ulrich Zwingli, they broke further than what Luther was even comfortable with. And so he tried to rein some of them in and say, you're going too far now. Zwingli said, no, the when we take communion, we're just symbolically receiving Jesus. Luther said, no. It's not transubstantiation like the Catholic Church teaches. It doesn't literally become the body and blood of Jesus, but something mysterious happens here. This is an ordinance of Jesus himself. And so some of these, what they call radical reformers, they broke off even further than Luther did, and Luther would write against some of them towards the end of his life and say, they're going too far. So a Lutheran church today looks a whole lot more like a Catholic Mass than what you'd see at Life Point Church, that's for sure. It is liturgical. They do follow a church calendar. And so Luther, he was not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. He was simply saying, here's the reforms that need to be made. Primarily, the preaching of the gospel must take place. The practice of the two ordinances of baptism and the Lord's Supper must take place for it to be a true church. Luther did not believe that there was one person like the Pope who held all this power from Christ, but he also taught very strongly that the Bible isn't just a free-for-all, and anybody can get up and say, I read the Bible this morning, let me preach. Luther was very strong on preachers need to be trained in the scriptures. They need to understand how to interpret the scriptures before they can teach the scriptures. So again, some of the radical reformers were just kind of like, you know, the Mennonites and others who grew out of the Reformation would say, hey, we just get in a big room and we all sit there until the Holy Spirit moves somebody, and then somebody gets up and they just say, this is what God's saying to me. And Luther absolutely disagreed with that. He would say, no, the preaching of the word is vital. And a true church will have someone who is trained in the scriptures to proclaim the gospel to people. So, yeah. What else? Other questions? Yeah.
To disparage him, but like he also really didn't like Jews.
Yeah.
Like, I just wonder, where did that come from?
Well, nobody really knows where that came from. Late in Luther's life, early in Luther's life, Luther was saying, hey, treat the Jews well. Share the gospel with the Jews. They are God's people. Late in his life, Luther changed his mind. In the last 3 years of his life, he wrote some treaties against the Jews that were very, very harsh. He called on German princes to chase the Jews out of Germany if they caught them proselytizing or trying to take a Christian and make them, you know, turn them into a Jew, that they should be executed. Luther said some really hard things. In fact, as sad as it is to say, one of the main proponents that Hitler and some of the others used in their pogroms against the Jews was, look what Martin Luther had to say about the Jews. It's a sad thing. Luther was, he was not a perfect man by any stretch of the imagination. Nobody knows why he changed his mind. I think, and many think, that it had to do more with Luther's health. Luther had had a couple of heart attacks. Luther was, he had an abscess on his leg. He would have horrible migraines. He did have very bad problems with his bowels, constipation, things like that, which again, he loved to write about and tell people about. But he was in a lot of pain the last few years of his life. And he grew angry. There was a peasants' revolt in Germany that said, Luther's our champion. Peasants should rise up. And Luther said, absolutely not. You know, Luther was not for slavery, but he was for order in society. So he wrote against the peasants. And then when the Jews started to push back against Christianity, he wrote against the Jews. And there's really no excuse for it. You know, Luther, you know, he has some explaining to do before God, like all of us do. So... yeah, but there's no excuse for it. I think it had more to do with just his physical breakdown. Luther also lost a daughter who was 13 years old to death. And I'll tell you, if you can look it up online, but read what Luther wrote to a friend after his daughter died. It is heartbreaking. I mean, it's heartbreaking to hear anybody who loses a child, right? But he loved this daughter of his, and when she died, it really sucked the wind out of his sails. And the words that he writes to his friend are just heartbreaking. Here he is, a man with the world on his shoulders, you know, leading this great Reformation, and he loses a daughter, and it's almost as if everybody's like, get back to work, and he can't. And so he had tragedy in his life, too. Luther ended up getting married as a monk. He disavowed his priesthood, and he married a nun by the name of Catherine von Bora. His beloved Katie, he called her, and they had this beautiful, wonderful marriage. He actually tried to marry her off to somebody else, and the other person said no, and then another person said no, and she said, I don't want to marry anybody but you. And Luther said, I don't want to be married. But after he tried to marry her off her again, he finally said, okay, I'll marry you. So starts off as not very romantic at all, and actually turns into, at least from what Luther writes, a beautiful marriage, multiple children. They opened up their home, a big home there in Wittenberg that used to be part of the monastery. The monastery, those who had come to know Christ, they just gave it to Luther. And Luther, his home was constantly filled with guests. So, and Katie ran the household wonderfully, took care of all the financial stuff, distributed his writings, all those kind of things. She was a wonderful helpmate, godly woman, incredibly intelligent in her own right. And they had they really did have a wonderful marriage. But they lost this daughter, and it was a tragic loss for them. So those are some reasons why he might have done that. It doesn't excuse the fact that he did. He was absolutely anti-Semitic in the last few years of his life. But something changed because he wasn't at the beginning. So, what else? Other questions?
I have one. Yeah. Do you have a book you would recommend if you just want, you know, like many books?
Yeah. Yeah, I brought two in. One called Turning Points by Mark Knoll. Not just about the Reformation, but about the early, but it's just a really good overview of the early church all the way up through the Reformation. He also gets into some modern day stuff, and I love history, but for some reason I don't like modern history. So if you get past World War II, I lose interest. So I have to be honest with you and say I haven't read the last few chapters of this book because I'm not interested in it. But the first part is really interesting, all the way through the Reformation. He's got a great chapter on the Reformation and on Luther. Turning Points by Mark Knoll. Mark Knoll is a Protestant who teaches at Notre Dame. Yeah, so. And then this one, it's called The Unquenchable Flame by Michael Reeves. Very short overview of the Reformation itself. The Unquenchable Flame by Michael Reeves. R-E-E-V-E-S. Michael Reeves, The Unquenchable Flame. There's others that are out there. I think The Unquenchable Flame is the best short. I mean, you can see it's not real long. Concise overview of what led to the Reformation itself, and then what we call the post-Reformation, and the Counter-Reformation. Anybody know what the Counter-Reformation was? In the mid-1500s, the Catholic Church says, hey, yeah, it was the Council of Trent, and they met for about 6 years, and the Catholic Church came together, and they said, anathema, or in other words, we abhor all that Luther taught, and here is how we're going to reform the church ourselves. And the Council of Trent did some very they cleaned up the church quite a bit there in the Counter-Reformation against, you know, the original Reformation there. No, they did not. Although indulgences are still around, you don't hear about them much, at least not in the Western church. If you go down, I mean, we lived in Costa Rica for a while. They're alive and well in Costa Rica. The veneration, the worship, quite frankly, of Mary, very strong in Latin America. You don't see it as much in the Western part of the Catholic Church, but there was a cathedral there in Costa Rica, actually outside of Costa Rica, a city called, I can't remember the name of the city now, but anyway, outside of San Jose, Cartago, there's a cathedral there that has a little relic of the Virgin Mary that hundreds of years ago, somebody said they placed it on a dying child and the child was revived, and so it is now a holy relic. And it has caught fire in Costa Rica in terms of its popularity. And so people will travel once a year to go there, and then once you get 1 mile from the cathedral, you get on your hands and knees and you crawl to the cathedral. And then on one day, they will bring out the relic and show it, and people will pray for healing for themselves or for other people. And you know, I mean, look, the reality is that's just idolatry. It's idolatry is what that is. And the Catholic Church doesn't really say this is a good thing. The problem I have with the Catholic Church is they don't condemn those things and say this is not right. And so you have processions in Costa Rica and San Jose where they literally have a priest carrying a cross with Mary crucified on the cross rather than Jesus, because she is the redemptress of heaven. You know, she's the one that you get to Jesus. How do you want to get to Jesus? Well, you go through his mom, right? Because he loved his mom, so you go to his mom. And there's some major problems with that. You don't see it much in the United States, but in Latin America, it's very, very strong. And indulgences are still very strong. To crawl to the cathedral and to pray to the shrine grants you a certain amount of indulgences, and I can't remember. But they'll show it on television, and you see people with just literally bloodied knees and elbows and hands who have crawled a mile to get to the cathedral. So my problem, I think, quite frankly, with the Catholic Church now I have some theological issues. But my biggest problem is they're not condemning outright idolatry, and they're not teaching people the proper. The church would say we do not worship anybody other than Jesus. We venerate the saints and Mary, which is not worship. But that's such a fine line that for most people it's hard not to pass the line. So.
I just wanted to say, if you like movies, there's a really good movie called Loser with Joseph Sinez.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's very...
Yeah, yeah, it is a very good movie. It's about, I think it's a full-length movie, right? About an hour and a half. Yeah, if I remember right, that may have a couple of fairly graphic scenes in it. Is that right? Is that the one?
Probably.
Yeah, so just be careful. There's a couple of, if I remember right, that has a couple of fairly graphic scenes in it. So
when we were in Greece, they told us that the reason the Catholic Church had statues and pictures was because years ago people couldn't read or write.
That's right.
So they had to tell the story.
That's right. Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. If you go into a lot of Catholic cathedrals, you see all kinds of artwork, and it is true. They become word pictures for people, and because so many people could not read, and again, quite frankly, could not understand Latin, the Bible was in pictures for them. So there's a lot of truth to that. Yes. Again, even some good things, right, can become bad things. Not just in the Catholic Church, but look, for those of us who are Protestant, we'd have to say, look at all the problems that good things that became horrendous things in the Protestant faith. So we have to be careful. You can't just throw stones from a distance. You have to recognize that that there are problems within Protestantism as well. Again, not trying to let off the Catholic Church. At one time, it was horribly corrupt. And again, I have some problems with this modern pope that we have right now. I think I don't think he's a very good Catholic, to be honest with you. He's not standing for the unborn. He's not standing against some very clear teachings of the church. And I think he's making some bad decisions, quite frankly. Lots of questions here. So, yeah.
How did Luther address the cornerstone on this rock? How did Luther, in his writings, which I have not read, but did he address the rock? How did he get around them?
Yeah. So the question is, and for the first time I'll repeat a question, because I haven't been doing that. The question is how did Luther address the issue of Matthew 16, where it does look like Jesus is saying, I'm going to build a church on you. I can't remember exactly Luther's words on this. I can tell you what the general Protestant response to that is, and that is the way that is phrased. It could mean that Jesus is saying, Peter, on you I'm building the church. It could also mean very clearly, upon this rock I build the church, Jesus. You are Peter, and upon this rock I build the church. Very likely that could be what Jesus was saying. It could also be, by how that is written in the original Greek language there, it could also mean, upon your confession. You just now said you are the Christ, the Son of God. Upon that confession, that rock, I'm going to build my church. Now, the Catholic Church would say, no, 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 it's clear. He's saying, Peter, you're a rock, and I'm going to build my church on you, and we're going to build a church right on your grave. And I would say, maybe. But there's a couple others, very clear options there that sound, when you take the totality of the scriptures, far more rational than, on one human being, I'm going to build the church of Jesus Christ. So.
But even at that, you wonder how Christ wouldn't be necessary.
Well, that was one of Luther's arguments and the arguments of the early Protestant reformers, right? You take indulgences, you take Peter, you take all these things, Mary is the Queen of Heaven, all these things, the sacrifice of Jesus is really not necessary. You've just taken Jesus out of the equation. So, yeah, big issues there. You said you had a question earlier, Mariana.
So the Reformation started in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Did it, obviously it's not going to spread like it would today, but quickly then from Germany it went to via his writings and other people just picked up and
The question is, did it spread quickly? And yes, for that day and age it spread incredibly quickly. Again, the unquenchable fire, the title of that book, it spread like wildfire. The printing press, these things were going out. Listen, there were already literally hundreds of scholars who were saying, all you gotta do is read the scriptures and know there's some major problems here. And Luther's the one who sparked it, but when he sparked it, again, within a few years, it's in Great Britain. I mean, if you remember, you'd have to look at a map of Europe, but you know, Germany is not far from England, and these are not huge distances even in that day to travel. And so it spread very, very quickly into Geneva, Switzerland, where you know John Calvin was, and Farel and some others, and into Great Britain with Tyndale and Knox, into Scotland, and all through Germany. And again, some horrible things happened. If you ever read about the mess up at the city of Munster in Germany, the radical reformers just went nuts there and were killing people. It was a mess. Into Spain. Now, the church was able to hold Spain and hold back that quite a bit, primarily by the use of what? Anybody know what the church responded to in Spain to fight back the Reformation? The Inquisition. The Inquisition was instituted in Spain. So, but yes, it spread very, very quickly, very quickly.
So my question kind of is with her. So how did it spread within the lower class? I read like a biography on Hannah Moore, who was an abolitionist, but during that time, and like, one of the things she often even said in like was an attitude of, you don't want to give the poor too much information because then they're not going to be happy with where they are. So like, was that still a, you know, like, was it mostly just still learned people were getting this information, and how did that disseminate through to the lower?
Yeah, how did the Reformation reach the peasant class in that day and age? And that's a great question. And here's how it happened, almost exclusively, the preaching of the word. That's what happened. They went from the mass to the proclamation of the word. Luther established that. It was established even amongst the radical reformers. It was the preaching of the word in the vernacular of the people. People were now hearing the Bible proclaimed and expounded upon in their own language. And yes, did it create some problems? I mean, this is what the Johann Eck said to Luther when Luther said, I'm going to stand on Scripture alone, prove me wrong. He said, we can't just have one friar, one monk, after 1,200 years of church history, say, no, prove me wrong. Anybody could do that. And now you've got, we don't know where to stand on anything. He's basically saying, we need the church to hold things together. And he wasn't completely wrong about that. Because look what happened when this Protestant fires began to spread. You get some pretty strange ideas coming up too, right? The Bible says this, I'm going to do this. Now God gave me this word, and I'm going to go do this. And it can get a little bit squirrely, no question about it. Look, the reason why we have New Testament letters primarily is because there were problems in the New Testament church. People were hearing the preaching, and they were taking it and doing some things that they shouldn't be doing with it. And so now Paul and Peter and James are writing back and saying, whoa, 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 wait a minute. This is what we need. Again, this is what I stressed last Sunday if you were at LifePoint, and that is the apostolic foundation of the church. Luther was right. We need people who are studying the word. You can't just have anybody get up and say, this is what God told me to do. At the same time, if you oppress so much that you just have one person, look, there's problems on both ends of the spectrum. You know what the problem is? Sin. That's the problem. The problem is sin. Whether it's in the Catholic Church or the Protestant Church, the problem is sin and a misunderstanding of the Scriptures and applying things that are not true. This is why it's so important for us to get into the Word, know the Word, study the Word, and then to have at least enough common sense amongst us to say, we're all going to stand before God one day, and none of us is going to be 100% right.
That's right.
Right? So hold to the foundational things and understand there are some secondary and tertiary issues that we're going to debate about. And if we hold those as if they're the most important things, now we're creating some big problems. But if we hold them lightly, we recognize here's the foundational truths. We'll stand on those. We may disagree on some of these things, but we can still be brothers and sisters in Christ on those kind of things. Luther, quite frankly, kind of went, here's one extreme, here's my extreme. And I think that the church has leveled out on some of those things, but certainly not perfectly. You can take good biblical things and do really bad things with them. So that's what we're capable of as sinful human beings. So I think my time is up. Any last question?
I just have a comment.
Yeah.
You can probably deduce then that, like Paul and the apostles, Luther was called by God.
I think there's no doubt. In my mind, there's no doubt that Luther was called by God. Yes. And by that, I don't mean like another pope. He was at the right time, at the right place. God put him there. He was well-trained. He was well-educated, which they needed at that time. Remember, the disciples, they were fishermen, right? They were trained by Jesus. But it's not long after that you get a guy named Paul who comes into the picture, who is very well-educated, very well-trained, and he can write a letter like the Romans, which is full of theology and doctrine, and he can go to the Old Testament and say, let's break this down and show how it applies and what it means for us. So we need both. I think Luther was definitely called by God, not just Luther. Again, we think Protestant Reformation, we think Luther. He was the main spark, I think, unquestionably, but there were so many others from within and without the Catholic Church who were reforming things and trying to get things as right as we could get them. So that's a good question. Yeah. I took all your time. So
that's fine.
Ladies, thank you very much for listening and for your questions. And I appreciate the opportunity to come in and share with y'all. So have a wonderful day.
Okay, ladies, it's an Arby's kind of day. So.